Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hi there. I'm Rand Abdelfattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
From KQED.
Hey, everybody. It's that time again for Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. And tonight, a Valentine's Day edition of the Breakdown. It's super romantic, right?
Yeah, and we don't have any red roses or chocolate, although I did go to See's Candy to try to get some. Couldn't. Too long a line.
Yes, yeah.
But we are thrilled to have with us the top dog of the State Assembly, the Speaker, Anthony Rendon, from Los Angeles.
He follows in the footsteps of people like Willie Brown, Antonio Villaraigosa, John Perez, Tony Atkins, all speakers who left their mark on the Capitol.
Indeed they did, for better and worse, we might say. But first, let's check in on some of the other stuff, Marisa. Of course, the governor this week gave a little speech. Gavin Newsom laid out his agenda for California with his State of the State address on Tuesday, I believe it was.
That's right. And I mean, high level here, after 8 years of Brown, it was long.
Long. It was long. There was an over.
45 minutes.
I had the over-under at 70. It was quite a bit under that. Yeah, it was like 45 minutes or so.
I don't think it was too long, but it covered a lot. I think, you know, Brown kind of tried to get in and out and move on. And
check
I think
the box.
This speech showed their stylistic differences, but also kind of planted the flag on differing himself on a couple of issues, including the one that has gotten national attention.
High-speed rail. If he thought he was putting that controversy to bed, it is not wanting to go to sleep.
No, let's hear a couple seconds of how he framed this.
Let's be real. The current project, as planned, would cost too much and respectfully take too long. There's been too little oversight and not enough transparency. Right now, there simply isn't a path to get from Sacramento to San Diego, let alone from, you know, San Francisco to LA. I wish there were.
So, you know, he comes out with this. I think he's trying to be clear about what he wants. And then all the headlines are Gavin Newsom kills high-speed rail.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's just say back up for a second. It's not a surprise at all that he's talked about this during the campaign. He realized the money wasn't there to build the whole thing. So I don't know if it was a stylistic or a messaging thing, but all sides kind of read into it what they wanted to. I think there was some concerns that he wasn't building the whole thing. There were others that were glad. Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, thrilled. Trump tweeting, now I want that $3.5 billion back. But then there were other folks who, after talking with him a little further, thought, well, this really just reflects reality. The money isn't there. Let's finish the part in the valley.
Yeah, but I feel like from a communications perspective, it was not the best rollout of this, because their press office was having to call all these media outlets and say, no, that headline's wrong. We didn't kill high-speed rail. And that's like not what you want your kind of first, you know, coming out on the national stage on something like this to be. And I think, again, I mean, maybe it will ultimately prove to be smart because, as you said, everybody sort of sees what they want to see in this.
Yeah, but I think he was maybe hoping to kind of turn the page a little bit on this issue, as he did also with the Delta tunnels. Maybe we'll get to that later. But, you know, I think it just muddied the waters to a certain extent. And I think ultimately, what does he want to do? I mean, if there were a Democrat in the White House and suddenly the Congress was going to give some money to states like California for high-speed rail, I'm sure he'd be delighted to build the rest of it. But with all the problems Jerry Brown has had, I think he wanted to say, look, that was his legacy project. Right. It's not going to be my legacy project.
And he also announced that he wants one tunnel, not two, under the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, which is this huge water conveyance project that was sort of another pet project of Brown's. Again, a lot of sort of unanswered questions about what that means for that project. Does it mean they have to go back to the drawing board on permitting? It's been a decade-long process already.
And we should say those two things were after the National Guard stuff and Trump, which was handled briefly. Those were the top items in the speech.
Right.
So clearly he wanted to get that out there. And, it's interesting. You know, it's no secret Jerry Brown and Gavin Newsom were not besties. I think they were, they had some difficulties in their relationship. And I think it made it easier, a lot easier, and maybe even a little bit of, I don't know, schadenfreude is the right word, but, you know, glee in turning the page and saying, look, we're not going to do it the way the previous administration wanted to do it.
And there were a lot of other things in the speech, too, of course. All of these announcements about appointments he's making.
Drinking water.
Yeah, on clean drinking water. He actually went down to the Central Valley. And that's one thing you and I have been talking about a lot is this focus. I think he is really trying to give an olive branch in some ways to communities that have maybe felt ignored in this state. And I think that it's interesting because on the one hand, the Twin Tunnels are something that a lot of, water districts down south do want, that agriculture likes more than, say, environmentalists. So is that a nod for them? But then you're going to build this train and there's a lot of people in the Central Valley who don't want it because they don't want their land taken away. So it's an interesting balance.
It is. And we have a guest that we can talk about some of these things with in a moment. But we're going to take a short break then. And when we come back, we'll have our conversation with Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Sasha Coca, host of the California Report magazine. Every week, we bring you stories about what connects us in the giant, diverse Golden State. Because what happens in California changes the world.
I love this place. We were once seen as, like, the place to be, California. The land of milk and honey. That's where you go to Sunshine State. But we just have challenges right now.
KQED's California Report magazine. New episodes drop every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Glenn Washington from Snap Judgment. And if you love what you're hearing, and I know you love what you're hearing, please consider becoming a KQED member. You get special access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. Plus, you'll sleep better at night knowing you did your part for the community you depend upon. It's in you. Please be in it. Visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to sign up now. That's podcast with an S. Thanks.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer. And our guest tonight is the man widely regarded as one of the most powerful people in Sacramento, Speaker of the State Assembly, Anthony Rendon. Speaker Rendon, welcome to the Breakdown.
Good to have
you. Happy to be here.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you. Happy Valentine's Day to you.
You're not wearing red.
I'm not.
None of us are, I should point out.
That's okay. Well, it's radio, so you didn't even have to tell anybody.
I am wearing red.
Well, Speaker, you know, we want to talk about your life and a lot of the non-policy things, but first, what was your reaction to the speech? What did you think?
It was a good speech, wide-ranging. He touched, obviously, on a lot of different issues, very different from Jerry Brown, both in terms of style and substance. A lot of the big legacy projects of Jerry Brown. The current governor seems to be taking a different turn on him.
Do you think my take on some of that was that part of the reason he was willing or eager to do it was because he didn't want those issues sort of be monkeys on his back and kind of move on? Did you see it that way? If you were Jerry Brown, might you have seen that a little like as disrespect?
I'm not sure. Different governor, different perspectives. The long-range plans for Gavin Newsom will naturally be different than the long-range plans for Jerry Brown. So I don't know that if I were Jerry Brown, I would feel disrespected, but certainly within Governor Newsom's purview to take those positions.
High-speed rail.
Yep.
So after the speech, I think you and Senator Atkins spoke and said you were a little concerned that the train's not going to go to L.A., and she said the same about her city, San Diego.
Yeah.
So where does this go then?
Hopefully eventually to L.A. and San Diego and San Francisco and Sacramento. I do think that there are clearly problems with the project. I think that the governor's good faith effort to conduct more audits and look at the program more closely and more carefully is a great thing. And hopefully it'll help to, buy back some public confidence. I mean, when I come home on weekends, it's the first thing my mom wants to talk to me about is quote unquote the damn train. I talked to the head of the French railroad about 3 months ago, and he said, high speed rail makes a lot of sense. It's a great idea. You have to do it. Make sure it links to urban areas of 4 million people or more. Merced and Bakersfield are fine communities. Economic development in both is important to us and to the state. But in terms of viability, it has to link the Bay Area and Los Angeles and eventually San Diego.
There were a lot of issues that he mentioned. We ticked off some of them. Do you think it's, you know, it's, I guess it's new for, it's good. It's, it makes sense that a new governor is going to come in and have a big agenda. Jerry Brown had two or three things that he really focused on. Is it a potentially a problem, do you think, to have so many priorities?
I think either route has its advantages and disadvantages. With Jerry Brown, you knew that there were two or three things he was interested in. That made it easier for us to sort of focus on those and say, like, we're gonna work on those, and over here these are our interests. With this governor, you're right, there are more areas of interest, but that to an extent also gives him a little bit more power, because he's not completely dependent. His own personal success for a given year, for example, a given legislative session, isn't dependent on one or two.
So it's not like all your eggs in one basket.
Exactly.
Gives you guys more openings. Well, we can get back to some of that, but I want to back up, talk about a little bit about you and your life. So you grew up in L.A. Your grandparents, I believe, were Mexican immigrants.
Yep. All four of them.
All four. Yep. Interesting. Did that play a big role, like, in your house growing up? I mean, did you guys grow up speaking Spanish? Was it, I don't know, was that sort of front of mind at all?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, the communities I grew up in, we moved a couple of times, were certainly largely immigrant families, and certainly led to the first couple of jobs that I had were for largely for Latino nonprofit organizations. My family, both extended and personal, suffered through, four or five cousins killed in gang violence.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of the hardships that immigrant families face were not unfamiliar to me.
To what extent was your family, a lot of times first, second generation kids are kind of pushed toward, don't speak Spanish or whatever the language was of the grandparents. I mean, to what extent was that true for you and your family?
Yeah, we didn't speak a lot of Spanish. My parents tended to speak Spanish when they were trying to keep secrets from us. I certainly do think it's generational. I think there's a very different consciousness now. Part of that is, I think, relating to where we are as a society, the idea of, education, international business, and all of those types of things. I think we tend to see those things as advantages now.
So you... I think it's been pretty well documented. We're not the best student growing up. We're not that interested in school.
Yeah.
And then you end up getting a PhD later on. So, like, talk us through a little bit of that. And, I mean, it must be in some ways, given that, a surprise to see where you've ended up for your family.
Oh, it is. Yeah, it's a surprise for a lot of people, myself included.
Was it a 0.8 grade average at 1.8?
0.8.
0.8, yeah. Whittier High School.
California High School in Whittier. I was once at an event with Antonio Villaraigosa, and he gave a speech where he said he had a 1.2, and I came back and told him he was a show-off. I was not interested in school. I wouldn't say I was all that academically talented. I do think what happened was that I'm a big believer in a liberal arts education, and once I went to community college and had an opportunity to take classes in art and in philosophy and in music and things that that really kind of spoke to me. That changed my whole life.
What about do you have siblings?
I have three sisters, one older, two younger.
And were they more interested in school than you?
That's a good question. And now you're like, getting at the, it's a great question. Yeah, I had an older sister, straight A student. I would be lying to you if I said I didn't have a little bit of resentment when I was 17 years old and a lousy student, and she was getting straight A's, and first day of class they would read the roll and they'd ask if I was related to Elizabeth, and I'd say yes, and then the end of the semester they'd say, what's wrong with you? And she had a big, I was working in factories and warehouses. I was 20. She was in college doing well, and she kept Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. She kept taking that book and putting it first on my nightstand, first on my dresser, then on my nightstand, then on my pillow. And she was very subtly
trying to... That's like a pretty, like...
It's a big leap.
You might want to start with a little more entry level.
Yeah, Clifford the Big Red Dog.
Mark Twain.
Yeah, and then so the story of that was I decided to read it, and I did, and then she tested me on it. It was like... it was a 700-page book, and she tested my on it, and she kept saying, what about the Grand Inquisitor? I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. And then she flipped through my book and discovered that it was abridged. So then she made me read the entire, I think it's 1,100 pages, instead of the 700-page version.
So well, it sounds like she maybe pushed you more than your parents.
Yeah, I think my parents...
Did they expect you to go to college?
I don't think they did. No, I don't think... You know, they wanted us to be, you know, good people and to work hard, but not necessarily. You know, I don't think that sort of was a big part of the ethos in our family. But yeah, I mean, she was the first in her family to go to college, and there was, you know, she kind of guided the way for us to a large extent.
What was it about, you know, philosophy and, you know, those sort of, you know, very intellectual kinds of topics that drew you in?
You know, what's interesting, and I think this to this day, is that those questions, yeah, they're abstract, but they seem very tangible and very real to me. I think the questions that, you know, the five fundamental questions of philosophy: what is justice? What is truth? What is the nature of our lives? What is right? What is wrong? What is beauty? Those questions are questions that, in different ways, hopefully we all ask ourselves every day. I certainly do.
And especially as a policymaker, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, a lot of those are really, like, fundamental
you
to that.
Absolutely have to.
So the other thing that's kind of well known about you is you're into punk rock. Was that, like, a love that came in your teenage years when you were feeling a little bit maybe more disaffected?
Yeah.
Or was that later on?
You know, it's both. It's interesting. I mean, you know, when I was in my teenage years, certainly, I think what I realized more recently was that sort of intellectually in my doctorate program, a postdoctorate programs, I became again sort of reinvested in punk, and so now I view punk very differently.
Yeah,
means the same thing to me, but I view it differently.
So what are your favorite?
Oh, I mean, at the time, I like X and the Germs, Social D. Everybody in Southern California likes Social D, right?
I saw them at some tiny clubs in San Diego.
Outstanding. Everybody loves Mike Ness.
Yeah. So you do go on, though, to get a PhD in political theory.
Yeah.
So what did you do, like, your thesis, your postdoc work on, and did that kind of help lead you, you think, down the path that you're on now?
My dissertation was on the relationship between aesthetic theory and political theory in the last third of the 20th century, mostly surrounding theories of play and playfulness. And no, it didn't lead me.
That has nothing to do with
it. It led me to the realization that I was probably going to be teaching at some random Dakota if I decided to follow an academic career. So I didn't.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED. I'm Scott Schaefer with Marisa Lagos, and our guest is Los Angeles Assemblyman Anthony Rendon, or Speaker Rendon, since that's the big title he has. You first got into elected office, I think, or you ran in 2012 for the state assembly, and you won. And then the very first year, you made a move to be speaker, and lost to Tony Atkins.
Yep.
I think it was. What was it that made you think, I'm going to go for the top job right out of the box?
There's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, if you recall, that was we were the biggest class, I think, since the Civil War. I'm forgetting now. At one point after the
because special, of term limits.
Because of term limits, there was also redistricting that occurred. So some folks ran for Congress, some folks ran for state Senate. So we were a huge class, and after about three or four special elections, that freshman class was more than half of our House. And, you know, so there was a sense that it would be somebody from our class. I think there was also a desire to... I worked in the nonprofit sector for about 20 years. There's a huge part of what the speaker does is administrative. I thought I could do the job. Ran, lost, probably learned a heck of a lot in the 2 years when I... the year and a half when I wasn't speaker. So
would you
think
learn?
It all turned out for the best. I learned how the building works.
Where things are. The difference between the four-digit offices and the three-digit.
And the three-digit, yeah.
Well, you did the water bond, too, right?
Did the water bond in 13-14.
That was a big... I mean, I feel like that was a big moment for you in terms of bringing together coalitions and sort of building
It took a lot
that.
Of heat for that, too.
Oh, yeah, it took a lot. I mean, I think if you do bonds correctly... no one is happy. Everyone's somewhat satisfied. And that was a great opportunity for me to, I lived in California for most of my life, but to travel around and to places like Seaside, to places like Hanford, to places like Stockton, to places like Humboldt, and to talk to people. We talked earlier about how philosophy can be abstract, so can water. And to talk to people in those communities about how water impacts their daily lives was really cool. And it was a great chance for me to spend time with my colleagues, too.
Do you feel like that helped sort of pave the groundwork for your run? Because you, you know, come from the more liberal, progressive wing of the party. You come, as you said, from nonprofits, early education, environmental work. But you really relied on what's known as the moderate Democrats up here, more business friendly, to get elected speaker. And I think that I would say that your leadership has been a balance of those interests ever since. I mean, was that kind of a good way to cut your teeth in that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think, you know, the moderates understand that there's not going to be a moderate speaker anytime soon. And I think the time I spent in Fresno, the time I spent in Hanford with the moderates was, you know, I think they understood. I'm like, hey, the guy's here to listen. I remember a Republican. I forget his name.
You weren't listening that well.
I was, down in Hanford. I went to his district, and he said, hey, like, you came and you listened to my people. Nobody does that.
Yeah.
Wasn't Valadeo, was it?
No, it's a guy he just lost in November to Melissa Hurtado.
Oh.
There's a lot of losses.
Gray so many hair, losses.
Nice guy.
We'll come back to
Welcome back.
Vidak. Andy
Vidak. Oh, Andy Vidak. Sorry. Yeah. Okay.
If he's listening, he's a great guy. Yeah. I just forgot his name.
All right, you're off his Christmas card list.
Thank you.
There's 80 lawmakers.
Yeah, there are a lot.
So there are lots of ways to be speaker. You know, Willie Brown, of course, was known as the Ayatollah of the Assembly. I think he was speaker for like 15 years. There were some speakers that are known for being effective, some not so much. You seem to be much more willing to let the members shine, to kind of take a step back a little bit. You're very low key. You're not, I don't think, someone who, you know, goes for the spotlight all the time. But, you know, when you think about your job and in the kind of personality you're going to have in that job, like, how do you think about it?
You know, it's interesting. My wife she's in a doctorate program right now. When she was working on her master's about 2 years ago, she was reading an article on Jess Andrew and his speakership and how he consolidated, centralized power. And we were kind of going through the article, and I felt like everything he did, I was
undoing.
Yeah, working really hard to not do.
Why?
Because I think it's a different era. First of all, we talked earlier how I got elected during, we were the first of the 12-year class. Mm-hmm. And if I was not speaker, if I was a member, an assembly member who wasn't speaker, I wouldn't want somebody dictating what I do for 12 years.
Why do you think there's a risk of being too deferential in a way to the members?
I think there are certain priorities that we want to accomplish as a caucus. I was pretty hard a couple of years ago on the transportation, our transportation plan, when a member didn't go up on it, and you know the member was punished. So I think there is, but I think you have to be clear with members. You have to be clear about expectations. You have to say this is what we expect, and this is what our priorities are, and go from there.
And so one of the other things, like, you don't run bills yourself,
right?
Changed a rule this year so that legislative committee chairs can actually just hold bills without a hearing.
Yep.
Those seem, again, like semi-risky propositions. I mean, in the sense that you do have, you know, say more moderate members.
Yeah.
Adam Gray runs GO. Like, how's he going to handle a tobacco bill that might be important to other wings of the party? Like, I don't know. Do you feel like you still have the influence to sort of put your thumb on the scale when those things happen because you built up goodwill?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, by virtue of the fact that I name chairs and have the potential to remove chairs and those types of things, I think I do. That being said, I think all the members know that there's like 7 freshmen right now. I've been spending a lot of time with them talking about the job. And the thing I always tell new members is, you know, you can act like a jerk at 8 a.m., to one of your colleagues, but at 9 or 10 a.m., you're going to be in front of them asking for a vote. And I think everybody sort of understands the sort of, you know, the dynamics of the building and that sort of internal karma that exists. So I think there is a system of checks and balances
just
that's built into the system.
Coming back to Willie Brown, and he wasn't alone, certainly, but he, you know, I think he was very good at consolidating, wielding power, collecting chits and using them, and twisting arms, really. Threatening members, I think it's fair to say. Yeah. Are you uncomfortable with that kind of style?
Um, it, it's necessary to do it sometimes, and I have. So, I mean, it's, if the ends justify the means, I'm okay with it. I think there are times when our caucus is...
What would it take to get you to that point?
A caucus priority. There were, in the past 3 years, there have been, I think, three different things where I said, we're going to do this. Mm. And in all three instances, we got them done. It wasn't easy. It was the transportation efforts, the cap and trade efforts, and the housing efforts. And, you know, none of those votes came easy.
So you mentioned the sort of currency of relationships a minute ago. And I know that you and Newsom had a kind of interesting dust up over single payer, which was was a bigger dust up with other members.
Largely on Twitter, I think, wasn't it? Or some of it, anyway.
Yeah, and, you know, the nurses came after you.
I don't even have my login.
But I'm curious, like, what has he, how have you guys worked to build the relationship now that he's governor?
Yeah.
What is it like, and how do things like that, like, how do you move past him?
It's been great. He's been great. I mean, our values are the same. We're both very progressive. I butt heads with my fellow progressives all the time, as often as I do with moderates. We've had, probably 3 or 4 coffees or breakfasts where we sit down and talk about things. I think, you know, the test of any relationship is not when you get along, it's when you don't.
Right.
Well, did you like kind of work through that single payer stuff? Did you get over your little coffees? Did you talk about that at all?
No, we never really did. We just talked about sort of moving forward. Yeah, we didn't, we never really talked about it. The bill in question's gone. So we never really talked
about it. How do you look back on that? Because so just for listeners who may not follow every twist and turn, right? The Senate passed this bill that sort of sought to implement a single payer healthcare system, mm-hmm. which is a huge, huge change.
Yep.
And you essentially held it in the assembly and said, we're not going up on this. I mean, I saw it as a way to sort of protect your members from taking a vote on a bill that you didn't think was really fleshed out.
And the governor would have vetoed, probably.
That's clear. For me, as somebody who worked in the nonprofit sector for 20 years, I take these things seriously. If you're going to tell people you're going to give them services, then you ought to give them services. This was a bill that did not identify how they're going to pay for a $400 billion program. This was a bill that didn't identify not only the funding source, the service delivery mechanism. It didn't talk about the fact that we need to get a Medi-Cal reimbursement from the federal government. It didn't talk about the GAN limit. It was a resolution. As a resolution, as a statement of values, it was fine. As a piece of legislation leading to the provision of social services, it was crap. It was right. There was nothing in it. It was garbage.
Do you think that having a governor who maybe shares a lot more of your priorities and your caucus's priorities and child care and early childhood education, parental leave,
clean water.
I mean, is that going to, because you know the sense was that the caucus had to bring Jerry Brown along, and he did things that he didn't really want to do, but you convinced him to do in terms of spending. How's it going to be different with this governor in that regard?
I think I almost feel as though it's going to be a little more granular. I feel like Governor Newsom's had a lot of meetings with our individual members to talk to with our utilities chair about energy issues, to talk to our health chair about health issues. And I think the sort of relationships between the individual chairs and the governor or the governor's office are going to kind of determine how we deal with those particular issues and the particularities of those issues. Like you talked about earlier, like we talked about earlier, Jerry Brown cared about half of a handful of things.
Three fingers.
So it was a different kind of a dynamic. And I think that actually gave me more power because I was sort of delivering for the caucus on these very specific and large items.
All right. Well, we have like just a few seconds left. I'm curious, though. You could be in this role till 2024, I believe. And then what? Are you going to go be that college professor?
Yeah.
Punk rock musician.
I always said my first job was at the Museum of Contemporary Art in L.A. I always said, I started my career in the arts and I wanted to end in the arts. That being said, I think I have maybe 2 more jobs left. So I'm not sure I'm going to go straight to the arts. I do. I miss academia a lot. I miss writing. I miss students. I think the irony is I really hated university politics.
Well, now you're probably way better at it.
Maybe, or less patient. So I'd love to go back to academia and then finally to an arts institution of some kind.
All right. Well, Speaker Rendon, thank you so much for coming in, walking across the street and talking to us. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Happy Valentine's Day in the rain.
Appreciate it.
All right. Well, that does it for this edition of Political Breakdown, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our producer is Guy Marzorati, and our engineer today is Chris Hoff.
Vinny Tong is our managing editor. Ethan Lindsay is our executive editor. And Holly Kernan is our chief content officer. I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at @MLagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @ScottSchaefer. That is a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED. We'll see you next time, everybody.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mind Shift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.